Welcome to the latest edition of the Navigator newsletter. This is for the month July 2016, or if you follow the Kemetic calendar, the year is 6252. It was written and narrated by Paul Ifeomi Grant and produced by 3PD.
Greetings, this is Ifeomi Grant and welcome to the July issue of the Navigator newsletter. Well, we certainly live in interesting times. The Chinese proverb says, may you live in interesting times, which is actually a curse. And certainly these times are a little bit too interesting for myself at the moment. A lot has gone on since I last spoke via the podcast. Those of you who read the written version of the newsletter will know it's already gone out just over a week ago. But for those of you who like to catch a podcast as well, this issue is going to cover, number one issue will be the purge of African men, and number two will be Brexit, don't count your chickens. Okay, so lots has happened, and even as I've written the written version, events just keep unfolding, so it's very difficult to keep up with a monthly newsletter with the events happening all around the world. But in this issue, I want to first of all look at what's been happening in the United States with the, as I call it, the purge of African men and the executions by police officers of unarmed African men or African men who've had certificates allowing them to carry arms. Originally, when I wrote the this newsletter, it was going to be the June issue, and I'd dedicated it to some internal problems that I thought needed addressing within the African community. Then we had the Brexit result, and I received a number of emails and requests for analysis of the implications of Brexit. And then just as I thought I'd completed that piece of the newsletter puzzle, and I'd booked a session to record the podcast, we then had the high-profile police executions of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, followed by the killings of police officers in Dallas, which hit the headlines. And then even as I was writing the newsletter, the written version, we then had killings of police officers in Louisiana, Baton Rouge in Louisiana. So in this issue, I'm going to say a few words, rather more than a few as usual, about what's happening in the U.S., and my sole purpose will really be to contextualize these events rather than providing you with a sort of blow-by-blow analysis of the individual incidents. I'm also then, going to cover the fallout from the referendum in the UK with regard to leaving the European Union. Okay, so get your hot chocolate or your hot drink or settle down because it's going to be quite a big newsletter. Okay, but before we just start and get into the purge, I just want to highlight what I've already written in the written version, which is that I've uploaded a new interview onto the blackfinancialfitness.com website, an interview with Dr. Rhoda Malifi, who's an oncologist who works here in the UK. I think you're going to find her story really, really interesting. As you may know, the success series is about me interviewing people who I believe can share some of the key secrets of success. Doesn't matter what field you're in, there's always certain common themes and threads you'll find in people who've been successful in any walk of life. And there's already two interviews up on the website in the success series, and Dr. Malifi's interview is now up. She was educated in Africa, the Caribbean and the UK, which is fairly unusual, I think. And I think you'll find her life story really, really interesting. If you've got teenagers or young people who aspire to do well academically, to be doctors, or who just want to hear a story that can motivate them, and even for older people such as myself and others, I'm sure it'd be a very inspiring story to listen to. So you can go to blackfinancialfitness.com/media and you can find the interview there. Okay, so let's get on to the first really meaty item, which is the purge of African men. And before I go into the current events, I want to give you the historical context because, you know, as Malcolm X said, of all subjects, history's best place to reward our studies. So it's important to understand the historical context because it very much is important and pertinent to what's going on now. So ever since the creation of the United States of America in 1776, the police, in whatever guise they operated, have always been at the forefront of oppressing African people and maintaining the system of white supremacy or white domination, because white supremacy is the ideology, white domination is the practice. Now, during the formal enslavement period, every adult white male had a legal duty to apprehend and return any runaway African they came across. This was part of the what they called the slave codes, which were introduced, which were followed by the so-called black codes. So effectively, every white male was deputized, and we saw the kind of contemporary manifestation of this with the murder of Trayvon Martin by George Zimmerman, who hunted down the teenager, who, as you know, was unarmed. And, you know, George Zimmerman was what I'd call a wannabe white. His father was classified as white, and his mother, I suppose, would be classified Hispanic, and perhaps classified as non-white. But he was a wannabe white man, and because of what he did, he was very much supported in the white media. And we also have to be cognizant of the Dred Scott ruling. Now, when I sort of took some of the research around the Dred Scott ruling, the narratives I found on websites says that Dred Scott was a slave whose owner, an army doctor, had spent time in Illinois, which was a free state at the time, and also Wisconsin, which was a free territory. Wisconsin wasn't a state, it was a free territory at the time of Scott's residence. So the Supreme Court that made the Dred Scott ruling was stacked in favour of the slave states. Five of the nine justices were from the South, while another, Robert Greer of Pennsylvania, was staunchly pro-slavery. Chief Justice Roger B. Taney wrote the majority decision, which was issued on March 6, 1857. The court held that Scott was not free based on his residence in either Illinois or Wisconsin because he was not considered a person under the US Constitution. In the opinion of the justices, black people were not considered citizens when the Constitution was drafted in 1787. According to Chief Justice Taney, Dred Scott was a property of his owner, and property could not be taken from a person without due process of law. So basically, Dred Scott had been arguing that because he'd been in non-slave-owning states or free states, as they were known, that he should have had his freedom. And the Supreme Court confirmed that he was a non-person and that the creators of the US Constitution did not write the Constitution with Africans in mind, you know, all the stuff about liberty and all the rest of it. So this ruling was underpinned by the judicial philosophy of what they call original intent, which Supreme Court justices, such as even up to today, Clarence the Negro Thomas, I think his birth name is actually Clarence Thomas, but he's a, well, I'm sure you know he's a disgraceful individual. People such as him have closely identified with this idea of original intent. When he was nominated for the Supreme Court, Clarence Thomas was quite open and proud to say that original intent was his judicial philosophy. So basically, Chief Justice Taney and his colleagues held that African people who had been imported into the US as slaves or were descendants of people imported as slaves had no rights that a white man was bound to respect or guarantee. And so this ruling and others helped to codify into law the philosophical underpinnings of what we call white supremacy, and reinforced the idea that Africans were non-people and hence that they could be assaulted and murdered without consequence. So this was part of the philosophical and judicial ideas that still carry through to the present day, even though they're not espoused openly. So the US prison system was essentially created at the end of formal slavery to capture the newly so-called emancipated Africans. So just prior to the end of formal enslavement, around 50% of the US prison population was comprised of Africans, even though most Africans were enslaved at the time. Now, as I've explained to you in previous editions of the newsletter, after the end of formal enslavement in 1863, a new period of re-enslavement began following the withdrawal of government troops from the southern states in the Compromise of 1877. So you had a short window between 1863 and 1877 when troops from the federal government were stationed in the southern states to effectively protect Africans from the backlash that they knew would come from the whites in the south who were angry about the end of formal enslavement. In 1877, we had what's called the Compromise of 1877, which was a purported informal, unwritten deal that settled the intensely disputed 1876 US presidential election. So what it resulted in was that the Republicans, who in the end ended up with the presidency, agreed as part of this compromise to pull out the last federal troops out of the South, and that formally ended what they called the Reconstruction era. So through the compromise, Republican presidential candidate Rutherford B. Hayes was awarded the White House over the Democrat Samuel J. Tilden on the understanding that Hayes would remove the federal troops whose support was essential for the survival of Republican state governments in South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana. The compromise involved Democrats who controlled the House of Representatives, allowing the decision of the Electoral Commission to take effect. Because remember, it's not the people who elect the president, it's the Electoral Commission, because you have to win the nominations in the various states. And then it goes as part of the Electoral College, and then it has to be agreed as part of this system as to who's the president. So the outgoing president, who was a Republican, Ulysses S. Grant, he removed the soldiers from Florida. As president, Hayes removed the remaining troops from South Carolina and Louisiana. So as soon as the troops left, many white Republicans also left, and the what they call the Redeemer Democrats took control. So it's interesting, which many Africans forget, that it was the so-called Dixiecrats or Democrats in the South who were the staunchest supporters of enslavement of Africans, and who also helped to bring into being and enforce Jim Crow segregation in the South. And it was actually what they call radical Republicans who called for reparations for Africans at the end of enslavement, the whole 40 acres and a mule. And the bit that people forget plus $200 was promoted and suggested by Republicans. So it's interesting how the whole sentiment has kind of flipped in terms of people understanding of the roles of Republicans and Democrats. And of course, the Democrats, Republicans have become an overt party of white supremacy, and the modern day Democrats, the party of covert white supremacy. So what exactly happened during this whole period in terms of the compromise is kind of contested, and there's not really much documentation around it. Black Republicans felt betrayed as they lost power and were subject to discrimination and harassment to suppress their voting. And by the turn of the 20th century, most blacks were effectively disenfranchised by state legislatures in every southern state. So in effect, most Africans had been were no longer able to vote in almost all the southern states by the end of the 19th century. And I put a YouTube link up, which gives you some insight and background into the compromise of 1877. So during that short-lived Reconstruction period between 1863 and 1877, Africans in the South, where the overwhelming majority lived, had made enormous educational, economic, political and social strides, which really incensed the whites, who had very recently possessed them as property. So almost as soon as the US troops left the South, the Democrats ensured the reintroduction of a full-blown white supremacist police terror state for Africans. And this is described very clearly in the book Slavery by Another Name by Douglas Blackman, which I've also mentioned previously in the newsletter, and which I definitely recommend that you read. You can get it very cheaply on Amazon for a second-hand copy. And they effectively reintroduce chattel slavery, which lasted up until the end of the Second European World War in 1945. Blackman, in his book, estimates that during this period, around 150,000 Africans were re-enslaved to work in mines, mills, farms, and other places of industrial production. So, one of the most interesting points to note was the role of the local police in the guise of sheriffs and deputies in this enslavement process, and how what you today we'd call stop and search, stop and arrest, was at the heart of the process. So I'm just going to explain to you how the process worked. So laws were introduced criminalising vagrancy and almost effectively criminalising being unemployed. Local sheriffs would stop unsuspecting Africans who were travelling around in search of work. They would ask them how much money they had on them. This was a kind of stop and search bit. The answer would normally be little or none. They would then arrest them for vagrancy. They'd lock the Africans in the local jail before presenting them to the local judge in the local court. And the judge was also in on the deal as well. He would get a cut, as I'll describe in a bit. The managers of the local coal mine or steel mill or whatever centre of industrial production it was in the local area, they would have been alerted to the fact that there's going to be some Africans appearing in court on these vagrancy charges. The judge would find the Africans guilty of vagrancy and then fine them. Of course, the prisoners couldn't pay the fine, so they were told they would have to go to jail. However, the manager of the local mine or farm or whatever it would be in court, and before the judge pronounced sentence, they would offer to pay the fine on the understanding that the Africans would be released into their custody to work off the fine. So let's say it's $10 fine, and they say, well, I'll pay you $1 a week, so you work for me for 10 weeks, you'll pay off the fine in that way, I'll get a worker. That was the charade that was played out. So the financial circle was completed by the payment of bribes to the judge and also the sheriffs and deputies for their services. So the steel mill owner or the coal mine owner would pay them fines and then tie up the Africans and take them off to go and work in the mill or the mine. So the Africans were taken to the mine, which was fenced off with armed guards in watchtowers, just like a contemporary US prison. And they would never be seen again, as the owners would then charge them fees for filthy accommodation, disgusting food, and whatever else they could charge them for, to such an extent that the fine could never be paid off. So they were effectively enslaved. And the Africans would live out a terrible existence, working in highly dangerous conditions, and they'd generally die within a relative short number of years due to either disease, workplace accidents, or at the hands of their fellow wretched slaves. There'd be a high level of sexual abuse and sexual violence, just like you have in the contemporary US prison system. And it's worth noting that the United States is recognized as the only country in the world where more men are raped than women because of their prison system. And just like in the current prison system, there was an epidemic of rape and sexual violence. And it was so similar to the current system because, of course, in present-day United States, prisoners work as slaves for US corporations. So many large US corporations have their goods produced by effectively slave labor working in the corporations because prisoners in the United States are not covered by the 13th, 14th and 15th amendments to the US Constitution, the amendments around which were there to end slavery of Africans. So you can see how little has changed in 150 years. We essentially have the same interest groups working in cahoots to criminalize and incarcerate Africans and mainly African men. So we have politicians, the police, the judiciary, the prison system, corporations, and they're all supported by the white media and most of the wider white public. Okay, so I'm going to break there, and in part two, we'll start to look at the numbers in terms of what's happening today with the killings of African men in the US.